talk a little bit of this later. Next case for argument is Curry versus Cass County Mental Hospital. Mr. Holly.
Please, the court, Brady and Holly on behalf of the plaintiff. The primary issue in this case is whether there is a factual issue created by the evidence as to whether the defendant's reason for terminating Ms. Curry in October of 1998 was pretextual or not. We have raised two bases for the pretextual nature of the discharge. And, but I want to talk very briefly about a couple of the facts because I think there's a difference in the reading of the factual record in this case between ourselves and the defendant. And I'd like to try to clear those up. Number one, of course, the discharge occurred as a result of a single therapy meeting between the plaintiff and a mother and a daughter, and a report that an intake worker who sat in that meeting wrote as a result of that meeting, which was interpreted by Mr. Cape as being a breach of the Illinois Mental Health and Confidentiality Act. Number one, the mother and the child, the confidentiality which they were concerned with in coming to this agency was not the confidentiality between the mother and the daughter, but confidentiality in the community, because the statement of Ms. Guerin indicates that she didn't want to go to the school counselor. That was the concern of the parent and the child. The mother, in this case, did not complain about Ms. Curry's asking her whether she had ever given permission for the minor to run away or to move out of the house or to go out of the house. And finally, to the extent that there's a suggestion that the manual...
I'm lost. What are her respiratory difficulties have to do with her work? Because it's a sedentary job, isn't it?
It's primarily a sedentary...
So what is the respiration have to do with it?
What's your theory?
They fired her because... Because of health benefits, cost, expense, or what?
Well, there are a number. That's not the basis upon which the.
Why do you think she was fired?
Well, a combination of both cost, absences, because the condition had gotten worse, so that she was missing more work. Plus, there were, and this is the subject of two counts that were voluntarily dismissed, but there were also attempts by her to obtain the right to park in some handicapped areas, which the defendant wanted to reserve for patients, and that temporarily occurred shortly prior to the discharge.
Mm-hmm. But was she warned in any way that there were problems with her absences?
Not that I'm aware of. There was never.
All right. So I'm just looking for what evidence you have to support that the company felt this way towards her.
Yeah. I don't think there was any
agency.
I don't think there was ever any indication of any problem with her performance. As a matter of fact, I think the record is clear that there was never any problem with her performance of her job at all up until this terminating event.
But I'm like Judge Posner, trying to figure out how her condition related to her discharge and the firing.
Well, only in the sense...
There's no evidence that anybody said anything to her.
That's
she
correct.
Didn't have any problem taking the days off. No indication that Kate didn't like asthmatics or anything like that.
No, I agree. Other than problems that were associated, because there were problems associated with the parking problem, which had gone on for quite a while in terms of her ability to...
Well, but there's no discussion of that in the brief. Did I miss that?
No, there isn't, because that was not the basis upon which the defendant sought summary judgment, nor is it a basis that was dealt with at all by the district court, because the only two issues that were dealt with
Well, I don't understand. What is the structure of your argument? Is this McDonnell Douglas that you're applying, or what?
Yes. What? In essence, yes.
Well, where's the evidence that other people were treated better who weren't disabled?
Other people?
Other employees. How do you get to first base if you don't show that some non-disabled person, you know, replaced her or what have you?
The only answer I can give to that is not, you know, fully developed in the record because it was never raised. I mean, it was never issued.
I don't know how you get to first base then. I mean, what's your argument? This person who happens to have a disability maybe of some sort is fired. Is that your prima facie case?
Well,
that's pretty skimpy.
Well,
I mean, the standard McDonnell Douglas person is black or woman or what have you is fired and is replaced by someone of a different group. And you show that the person was performing up to the employer's job expectations,
right,
but was fired and replaced by someone of the majority.
In this case, non-disabled.
And the burden shifts to show, you know, legitimate reason or non-invidious reason.
Judge, I can't point to anything, and the answer would be that you...
So you don't have any indication that she's being treated worse than a non-disabled person.
Well, if the evidence is that she's replaced by a non-disabled person, I would submit that that would satisfy the requirement that you're raising.
But I don't. Is that what you are? Is that what the evidence shows? That she was replaced by a non-disabled person?
Well, I'm not sure that it's developed within the.
Well, I don't know how you get to first base. That's part of the McDonnell Douglas pleading burden.
That's what's pled, and the answer is that would be the evidence if.
But if the other side moves for summary judgment, you have to show that you've satisfied the elements of the McDonnell Douglas test.
And I think that the record is that there was a replacement. I can't point to it in the record, but I think that was dealt with early on in the briefing process, but in the statement of facts. But I don't think that, as I said, it was never even raised. And hard for me to tell you what all the evidence is on that, since it was never raised. That argument was never even raised by the defense.
Okay.
Our basis in response to the trial court's conclusion is that this is patently false, the reason given. And it's basically a plain wording of the mental health statute, which indicates... that a mother has the right, the absolute right.
But they had a policy, didn't they, as well as the statute?
The policy, I think this is a total, this is a difference of opinion and interpretation. The policy that's in the record is to follow the Illinois Mental Health Act.
But it doesn't matter whether it's interpretive. What is your reason to think that they didn't fire her because of her breach of confidentiality, but for some other reason? I don't see any indication of that. Maybe they read their own policy wrong, but that doesn't, there's nothing invidious or pretextual about being an incompetent interpreter.
I think the cases indicate that, you know, if the reason is dishonest
means they say one thing and mean another. The fact that they may be mistaken or they're adopting an interpretation which is debatable doesn't mean they're being deceitful.
I just want to say factually that the portion of their regulation is simply a restatement of the statute. It is simply.
Well, what is the indication that they're acting deceitfully? She did breach a confidence. Doesn't seem that serious or could be justifiable, but it was a breach of confidence. This association is very concerned about that. So, what reason have we to doubt that that was the real motive for their discharging her?
Well, the I guess two reasons. One is that I think the plain reading of the statute is that they couldn't possibly have that interpretation given the fact that the person making the decision is a professional himself.
But when we depart from the plain meaning of statutes, are we being dishonest?
Or equivalently. we reverse a district court's decision, a decision made by a professional, do we demonstrate, therefore, that the district judge must have engaged in discrimination against the losing party? Because, after all, the district court had made an error. But that wouldn't be a very good inference, would it?
No, but we're dealing here with a situation which I think a plain reading of the statute. I mean, I don't think there's any subtle distinction here. The statute clearly says that the mother is entitled to information with respect to the child. And the other answer I give to Judge Posner, your question, is that the person who made the decision to terminate the plaintiff in this case turned around and violated the statute clearly by disclosing the identity and the content of the possessions of the child and the mother to the EEOC. So those are the reasons that we believe that this decision is incorrect.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Unrath?
Good morning, Your Honor. I was pleased to hear the court discussing the prima facie case. A recent decision of this court issued last month indicated that the prima facie case has been taken a second seat. Most courts jump directly to the discussion of pretext, and I believe that that's what happened in this particular case. We have four elements to the prima facie case. She must be a member of a protected class. We dispute that. We believe that she was ill, that she did have health problems, but these problems were accommodated by the her use of a nebulizer in the morning and afternoon. There's no indication in the record anywhere that her condition in any way caused a problem with her performing her duties as a counselor. Indeed, there's no indication that the Mental Health Association ever complained about the fact that she had breathing difficulties. To the contrary, the record indicates that they...
So what is her problem? Asthma? Is that it?
It appears to be something similar to asthma. COPD, a chronic obstructive
pulmonary disorder.
Yes. And we
That's
had...
different from asthma? Or?
I couldn't tell you, Your Honor. I do know that she had reported this to the association, and the association had given her an air purifier for her office.
Chronic obstructive pulmonary disorder is just a generic term. People who have black lung diseases have chronic obstructive pulmonary disorders. Very unlikely that Curry is suffering from black lung disease. It's just an umbrella term for a class of breathing disorders. It doesn't really help us figure out much.
Well, and I don't know as though we even need to know. I think that given the fact that there is absolutely no allegation in the record that the association ever complained about her disability, if we can call it that, her health problems, there's no indication that they had any conflict with this. The second element of the prima facie case is that she has to meet her employer's legitimate job expectations. She did not. She violated confidentiality of one of her clients. Now, the case law is widespread that we are not to look into the sufficiency of the motivation, where a de minimis infraction of employer's policy is sufficient in itself to overcome any argument of pretext. In this particular case, we have a mother and daughter that both express concerns about confidentiality. We also have a daughter who specifically told them that she was concerned about speaking in the same room with her mother. She did not want her mother to hear what she had to say. They assured her on numerous occasions.
Well, Mr. Holley says the mother has a statutory right to find out what her daughter said.
I disagree. I think that particularly in a situation like this, where they have both agreed to this particular format, that they would be interviewed separately, and
well,
that
the question whether she has a statutory right can be determined by looking at the statute. So what does the statute say?
The statute says that the mother can obtain any records of a adolescent. The communications do not fall within that purview. In other words, the things that she says to the counselor do not constitute
records.
Unless
Curry had first written them down. So on your view, the statutory question, whether the mother had a right to it, depends on whether Curry wrote down what the daughter said. Curry wrote down what the daughter said and put it in the files and records. The mother had a right to obtain it.
I think she probably
could. If
Curry
did not write it down, then it was forbidden for her to disclose it.
Yes.
That seems somewhat of a strange statutory system.
It does seem a little bit unusual, but I can tell you this. One thing that's significant here, the mother never requested these records. She never requested information. This was given after they had assured the mother that neither one of them would be told what the other said. Now, at that stage, the mother has to question, well, are the things that I'm saying being relayed to the daughter without her even asking? What is the whole purpose of this counseling session if they cannot trust the counselor when they say that they will keep these things confidential? The concept of trust, confidentiality, lies at the very heart of effective counseling. Now, when this child returns to high school and tells her friends, everything you say to a counselor at the Cass County Mental Health Association is going to be relayed directly to your parents. How many troubled youths are going to be seeking counseling after that? This infraction, this breach of the confidentiality policy, not only undermined the effectiveness of the counseling session, but it undermined the effectiveness of the association as a whole. We think that any argument suggesting that this is a de minimis infraction simply cannot hold water.
Let me just ask you this, because I'm curious, under this act and sort of the procedures they follow, at some point after this session, wouldn't the comments be reduced to writing, given I assume there's a high volume of a number of people that come in and out and to try to keep track of what people have said or what their issues are? Aren't things ultimately reduced to writing? Isn't there some requirement that what is said or what is discussed or what the issue is reduced to writing?
I would imagine so, but again, I'm speculating. And the detail that's put in these writings is something I can't speak to. It may simply be a general statement. Daughter having problems with mother, can't get along. We really have no way of knowing, and it really doesn't matter, particularly when the daughter was already told that this would be kept confidential. I think if you look at look away from the Medical Records Act and look at the Cass County confidentiality policy, it states that when the person served as a minor, any consent for disclosures must be given by the minor and the parent or guardian. In this case, the minor never gave her consent. Paragraph 5 of the Cass County confidentiality policy states that this act goes to the Medical Privacy Act. It says that the only grounds that you can use to divulge these without consent is when there is a bona fide medical emergency, qualified personnel for conducting scientific research, and so forth. These elements simply are not here. Finally, they've argued in their brief that the fact that the Cass County Association responded to a complaint before the EEOC and attached documentation describing the identities and the content of these counseling sessions demonstrates somehow a lack of interest in confidentiality. Plaintiff would have this court believe that Cass County really does not believe in confidentiality, that it really doesn't place that high a value on it. We submit that even if we assume, and this is a big assumption, but even if we assume that this disclosure to the EEOC constituted a violation of the Medical Records Act, the fact remains that this response divulging of information was not given during the context of a counseling session. It was given in response to a legal complaint. We submit that the Cass County Mental Health Association's release of this information has absolutely no bearing on how it actually treats its patients and its clients. We ask that the court affirm the decision of the district court. If there are no other questions.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you to both counsel.